da 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 da. Yeah, right. Can you name the Magnificent Seven? I can.
Go on.
Shall I? All right, I'll see if I can. Robert Vaughan, James Coburn, Steve McQueen, that's three. Charles Bronson, Horst Buchholz, that's five. Right? The big star, Yul Brynner. And the very difficult one, right? The one that nobody knows, Brad Davis.
And that's the voice of Mick Jones of The Clash, who together with the vocalist Joe Strum will be my special guest on The Lunch Show this afternoon at 2 o'clock. And for the uninitiated, The Clash, punk rock band, played at the Academic Community Hall, an incredible concert that lasted well over 2 hours, which we broadcast live here on commercial radio. And after the concert, I was escorted together with Freddie backstage by two very impressive looking roadies and taken into the dressing room to meet Joe Strummer and Mick Jones. And the first question I asked was, what was the story of The Clash?
The story starts in April 76 in a room upstairs in the back of a squat in Shepherd's Bush, where Mick Jones, Paul Simenon, Vivian Albertine and Keith Levine are living.
And Sid, we used to practice in a room about the size of any normal cupboard, and it had egg boxes on the wall, and we used to go in there and practice the songs, right? And until we managed to move out, and we went to Camden Town. The next step was Camden Town.
That's right. And then they asked me, Joe Strummer, to join the group, and I took 24 hours to decide to join it.
At that time, you were the 101s.
101 is an R&B group, yeah. So they disbanded, and I joined The Clash as soon as I saw Mick and Paul, because they looked kind of different from other people at the time.
Okay.
Like, all my friends thought they were weirdos.
And we thought all his friends are weirdos as well. Oh, we had another drummer at that time. His name was Terry Chimes, and then he left to be a shelf fitter, and
that's
how we got Topper after auditioning 206 drummers. Topper was 206th and got the job. We'd known him for a while. He didn't want to join at first, but later on he wanted to join when we started happening.
And then
first gig.
Yeah, then we moved to a famous, now famous warehouse in Camden Town.
Which we painted.
It's called
before we were allowed to practice, we had to paint the whole place.
For a month.
What colour did you paint it?
Pink and black.
Yeah, the colours the Roxy Club jibbed off us and painted the club when I started. But that was called rehearsals. Because that's all that went on there.
And it was taken, it was the property of British Rail.
And that was about the time you had your first album?
Before we even had a recording contract.
The first gig we played was supporting the Sex Pistols at the Mucky Duck in Sheffield.
That's Black Swan. We invited all the press that we could find in London to come and see us at our rehearsals, and we put on a little show, and Bernie's wife made sandwiches. Yeah, and they went wild and gave us great reviews.
Including, I hear, the Sunday Times.
Oh, well, they didn't turn around on us later.
Right, so. Anyway, to cut a long story short, on the 27th of January 1977, we signed a contract with CBS and put out a record that went in straight at number 12. And then we took out on the White Rat tour. And that's when the Sunday Times, they were more taken with our road crew than us, actually.
Yes, I heard some tales about one of the road crew's habits with Coke cans and cigarettes.
Well, that was the famous Roadie Rodent.
He used to do that.
Who ended up in Zimbabwe with Bob Marley.
And I'm talking about the gruesome twosome, Mick Jones and Joe Strummer.
The story has many turns, you know.
And when was your first album actually released?
In about April, May. And then we played the first big punk rock gig in London at the Rainbow, May the 9th.
Everybody smashed the seats, and we got on page 3 of the Sun. Mr. Rupert Murdoch. Owner.
And from then on, it was constant flogging around the grimy, satanic mills.
Since.
The dark satanic mills of Northern England, like Bradford Town Hall or
Blackburn Town Hall. Or set place Derby.
Derby Assembly Halls.
Or Cambridge Corn Exchange.
It's a BD.
And as we're talking, Joe Strummer's turning out the bottom of his trousers.
Well, you got to turn up to get down.
Stop that messing around.
And then what happened? So,
well, the concept of giving enough rope.
Oh yeah, the concept that expanded
into an idea.
That was when we
weren't concepting.
Like CBS tried to get it professional with us, and they thought they could make $1 million in America, which they haven't done even yet with us. And they got us, they gave us a list of producers, and the first one was Sandy Parman.
So we had him,
since we had to have one of these
and producers. And he had us.
And he was more, I don't know, he was more concerned with heavy guitars or, you know, Blue Oyster Cult, that was his bag. And so we kind of went through that record, and he took us to America for the first time, me and Mick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that sort of changed us.
How were you received in America at that time?
Well, we weren't playing, we were just recording there.
But they weren't.
We were just looking. Oh, it was just after the Sex Pistols had broken up.
They wouldn't play any of our records or anything like that on the radio.
At the time, they hadn't released our first album either because they said it wasn't professional sounding enough. And it took them 2 years to release their first album in America. They wouldn't release it because it didn't sound like all the rest of the rubbish on the radio.
So in other words, the album had been in existence for 2 years before it was released?
In America. It was released almost immediately. It was finished in England, where it was a great success, but American taste seems to take a little longer to...
And then we got to making an album called London Calling, which we made in London.
A man called Guy Stevens.
Yeah, famous, legendary Guy Stevens, Mott the Hoople, or Porco Harlem, Free, etc., etc. Guy Stevens, Sue Records. The guy who turned all the London beat boom groups onto R&B. The Who, the Small Faces. None of them knew what to play until they heard Guy's record collection.
They always used to go to his house.
How do you describe your music?
Well, sometimes it's awful, sometimes it's brilliant.
That puts it in a nutshell.
That's actually quite true, as far as live performances is concerned. But what happens on record is we spend ever such a long time now trying to get it so everybody likes it.
I mean, us.
Never
pay any attention to other people.
No.
Never do. It's only the people in the group. There's enough arguing amongst ourselves without other people, making it more confusing. But anyway, they said in England, they claimed London Calling was an attempt to get on American radio. But they're always accusing us of these things that never cross our minds. It's really odd. But we just...
Did it?
Yeah, we learned that. We wrote and rehearsed that album in a place in Pimlico.
We didn't have any plans, like, as if we were going to be a big hit in America or anything like that.
In fact,
there was nothing...
We thought it was our last chance in the studio because we owed the company so many $100,000.
At the time?
That we figured... This would be our last chance. Like, we weren't making it with the record sales. And we figured we're just going to make a record with the music we like. And all the critics slammed it in London. And nowadays they can be found going around CBS in London begging for copies of it. Even though they were the ones who, the very same people who put it down.
You probably only want to sell it since it's two records instead of one. They probably get more for it
because they think it's great now.
Yes, you go for Sandinista, you get three.
Yeah, well, they'll start saying that's great about next year.
Well, they sort of have. Quite a lot of them, people have retracted what they first said
about the Village Voice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 2 years running, they voted us that number one album for Sandinista and London Calling, the Village Voice, which is like critics all over America. Mm-hmm. So we're the critics' choice, if we ain't.
Yeah, then the critics take themselves seriously, don't they?
Yeah, they really do. They give you B pluses and A minuses and things. So.
It's also true that you've kept the cost of your albums down. You've insisted upon that.
Well, up to this point we have, but it's been to our great misfortune. Literally. I mean,
people seem to think there's something wrong with it if it's cheap. That's the psychology of capitalism, you know? If it's cheap, they think, well, it must be rubbish.
I mean, London Calling was a double album set, but you...
Two for the price of one, yeah.
And Sandinista triple album was three for the price.
Three for the price of one. But we had to, like, carry all the overheads, you know what I mean? We had to sell more than we had, sort of thing.
Do you have a very elite cult following?
Well, I don't know about that. We'd like to get across to all the people who aren't elite or cultists, you know? But it might be so, but we'd rather, like, get across to a much broader audience without having to compromise our music.
I mean, the people who come to our shows to hear one tune called White Riot, that's why we don't hardly ever play it.
They never get it.
Because we don't want those people, if that's all we want. You know, we want to play
the whole
music.
Thing, you know.
Yeah, the whole thing is music, and none of it's rubbish, you know.
What about Magnificent Seven?
Da 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 da. Yeah, right. Can you name the Magnificent Seven? I can.
Go on.
Shall I? All right, I'll see if I can. Robert Vaughan, James Coburn, Steve McQueen, that's three, Charles Bronson, Horst Buchholz, that's five. Right, the big star, Yul Brynner, and the very difficult one, right, the one that nobody knows, Brad Davis.
Excellent, well done.
There's seven.
And the Magnificent Seven is it was when we were in New York in early 1980, about April 1980, we started to record in Electric Ladyland, Jimi Hendrix's old studio, and we started to hear the funky music out of the Sugar Hill Gang, you know, Brooklyn rapping and stuff.
And it's sort of our 7 days, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's our week.
Now, you say your music is punk, yet it has a very strong reggae influence.
Yeah. That's right. And all sorts of other influences as well that we've assimilated and made into Clash punk rock. Yeah.
How many other bands can you name that play punk rock today in 1982?
Oh, I don't know.
There's millions of new punk bands in England, but it's music called Oi.
Can't name.
And I don't think it's going forward. You know, we always stress going forward, even though we lost a lot of people along the way. We wanted to stay back, you know? We don't see any point in staying back. We want to move forward.
But where are you moving in a musical direction?
That we're going to play better and better. You know, we're learning to play publicly.
Any plans for any new album?
Yes, we've got one on the go at the moment. It's in the oven. And it should be
out
sometime in the future.
When will it be cooked?
Well, hopefully at the end of April it'll be presented.
Any title yet?
Yes.
Go on.
It's the title, provisional, is The Rat Patrol from Fort Bragg with one G.
The Rat Patrol from Fort Bragg.
Yeah, but it might not be by the time we might change it.
Will that be a single or double album?
A single album with an added something or another.
A 45, 12 inch.
Hopefully.
And what about the Black Market Clash? Bank Robber Dub.
A collection of bits and pieces. Sort of things that hadn't been released before, some B-sides
that
aren't available.
In America on this new thing that they claimed
didn't catch on.
Is going to catch on, like called a 10-inch record.
Let's do the 10-inch thing.
We just put all the tracks that we hadn't released in America on.
They just released their best-known tracks on these 10-inch albums, you know what I mean? Cheap Trick and I don't know, whoever. They just released four of the tracks that we put, how many did we put on it?
Call it Boot 10, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
So this was only released in America?
Well, originally, it has since been released in Australia as a real album, but it doesn't really count. It's just something that they kind of thought up and we agreed to. And then the thing didn't catch on, the 10-inch record, you know what I mean? Because it didn't make the size, that size rack. It was a problem, right? And so it used to get lost amongst the 12-inch ones.
What about this tour? How long have you been on the road?
Well, I think we've been away from London since May, but that counts 2 months recording in New York as well. So we've done England, Europe, New York, Paris, Tokyo.
It's more England.
More England, more Europe, Australia, and now Hong Kong.
And New Zealand. And what do you think of the audience here in Hong Kong?
Very, very lively.
First Asian stage invasion.
Oh, I get it. Right. Because everybody was coming up on the stage. Do you like that, or does it annoy you?
Not at all. As long as we can carry on playing. If people are enjoying themselves, why not?
Won't really like it.
How many songs did you play on your set tonight?
Good question.
32.
And the show went on for something like 2.25 hours, so you must be really tired.
I'm ready to do it all again.
And where are you going to next?
Bangkok.
Bangkok. And after that?
Back to Ladbroke Grove.
Back to the UK.
Yeah.
Any plans for a tour in the summer?
I'm going to get a tan standing in the English rain.
We're going to tour in England and then we're going to tour America for the summer, taking a couple of weeks off for the World Cup.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Cheers, drummer.
Adios, amigo.
Good night.
Thank you. Mick Jones and Joe Strummer of The Clash.